The duplicate questions we got. Can you name a favorite of each one of the categories? Favorite name giver race in Earthdawn. Not necessarily to play, just favorite developed name giver race.
Oh, in terms of the way it's developed and the Scrang, almost without question. It would have been a toss-up between them and Obsidiman, but Don Rhodes did such a fantastic job with both the essay in Denizens of Earthdawn Volume 1 and the Serpent River book that it's just a fantastic culture the way he developed it. So I think if somebody were to say, what's a book that you can show me that really shows why Earthdawn is cool, I think the Serpent River would be right up there among my choices.
Yeah.
No argument from the two of us. You're our people. So favorite discipline?
Tough one. Probably the Swordmaster. Potentially some bias there because my wife played one in her early playtests, but still, very cool discipline.
Hey, whatever makes it your favorite, makes it your favorite. Any favorite spell?
Oh, God. Onion blood, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That one. I remember that one. And for those of you who don't know that one, go look it up.
Probably that or Razor Orb, perhaps. Just one of those.
Oh,
my God. Spells, right?
Yeah. This thing exists. That's a spell. Yeah, that's a spell.
Yeah.
Watch me work. Any favorite creature out of the bestiary?
I really think, though they don't work as great in the game as I wish they did, I love the look of Shadowmance.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, nothing as cool as a flying manta ray with a scorpion's tail, right? I mean...
Exactly.
Though...
That's just awesome. I love the two things mashed together.
I also do love Blood Monkeys, just because they played a fun role in my game.
Cool.
Every GM who's used Blood Monkeys, I think, loves them because they are invariably the adversary that is going to send player characters fleeing.
The creature I used to use a lot in my games, I never really used Blood Monkeys. I think I might have used them once or twice. My wife always wanted to use me to, like, where are the monkeys? Monkeys, monkeys, she wanted. And I'm like, you don't understand. If one of them hurts you at all, you guys are done. Like,
yeah.
Right? But the one I used a lot were Krogan.
Oh, they're lovely.
Mm. Yeah.
I would describe the Krogan and the players were like, kitties! But they knew they were in for a tough fight because they were 50 pounds of pain, but packaged up in a little 10-pound creature. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just my friend the Beastmaster just picked up a Krogan as a familiar now, so he likes it. Favorite horror?
I got to go with the Big V, Vergigorn.
Fair.
Yeah, no argument. And what's your favorite great dragon and why is it Mountain Shadow?
Yeah. I don't know why it's Mountain Shadow, but it is Mountain Shadow. It was kind of cool to be able to, you know, use him as the voice in the Dragon's Book and in some other places. And the fact that, you know, we knew who he was in Shadowrun was kind of fun. And that was a case where I couldn't have killed him because he was going to die in Shadowrun. So.
Fair enough. And do you have a favorite area of the world?
Or Barsave?
That was mentioned. I mean, I'm obviously probably Barsave because that was the most developed.
But. Yeah. So if the world or within Barsave?
The question posed was of the world. Interpret that as you wish.
Not really. And within Barsave, it's cheating, but I would probably have to say the Serpent River, even though it is almost all of Barsave. But again, just because the culture that sort of grew out of this Tuskrang is just so kind of cool and very unlike. Our take on trolls is different. Our take on orcs is different. Our Obsidiman are unique. Windlings are unique. Humans and blah, blah, blah. I don't know of another game that's got anything like Tuskrang in the same way in terms of how richly it's developed and just, you know, how the way they fit within the world and sort of embody this just coolness and just very unique fantasy world thing.
Yeah. And we can end the speculation. It is pronounced Tuskrang. Emphasis on the T, right?
So
all three get that the same way.
I figured we'd get some other pronunciations throughout this discussion.
And they're all wrong.
Whatever works at your table, right?
Yes, exactly.
As long as the person saying it and the person hearing it know who you're talking about, it doesn't really matter, you know?
Exactly. So on episode 50 something, this listener is way, way behind. Someone had asked why Barsev is set in modern day Ukraine and the surrounding area was chosen for the geographical setting. Josh said he didn't know. And that was a great question for Lou to answer. So why was Ukraine
that part chosen? Of the world.
This showed up on their Facebook group, I think.
Fair.
And I think I answered it back then, but this was one of the things, one of the few questions that I kind of knew was coming.
There you go.
I wasn't sure what else would be coming, but it's all good. So they knew the game was going to be set on Earth in the past, but they wanted to pick a place that was, as much as we have a European market and a Asian market, whatever, to buy our games, the vast majority of the game market is North America. So it had to be a place on Earth that was foreign to North American gamers, right? So it would look exotic and different to American, North American people. The other thing is they knew that Atlantis, that Thera was Atlantis, was Greece, was where it is, right?
Yeah.
And so it had to be close to that too. Hmm. You know, and again, I wasn't there at the time when they did this. I don't think they picked the place and said, ooh, look, Greece is right there. That's where Atlantis is supposed to be. We can use that. I'm pretty sure that it all kind of came up together. But a large part of it was to put it, it had to be on Earth, but they also didn't want it to be North America, like a place that was familiar in terms of geography to the players. That way it felt like an exotic new place.
Yeah.
And obviously the geography is not exact, right? It's, you know, where the mountains and rivers are is not exact, but it's kind of close.
Yeah, volcano.
So that's pretty much where it came from.
Okay, good to know. I think that'll settle that question from here on out. If you could write one more thing for Earth Dawn, what would it be?
That is an interesting question. I think I would have really liked to have completed Barsev at War. Even with my earlier comments about whether or not it had been successful or as successful as I hope it would be, mm-hmm. I was really fond of the story that we developed for that, like the overall flow of the events. The challenge was going to be how to incorporate the PCs, the player characters in those events in a way that made their contributions feel meaningful and that it was their story and not just background characters in this bigger epic that was happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair.
But that's probably the one I really wish I had had the chance to finish. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish that the Dragon's book had been published, really published, because I think up to that point, that's probably the best book we did. In terms of, and again, I showered praise on the Serpent River book earlier, and you know, I don't think we did any bad books. We could debate about the Theran Empire and why people love it or hate it, whatever, but the Dragon book just, like I said, it felt like some of the best work we'd ever done in terms of telling the story of this world, because we figured out a way to basically make a book about big intelligent lizards, but make it part of the big story and reveal some interesting stuff about the world that I don't think people ever saw coming.
Yeah.
But in terms of one more thing, probably Barsev at War. More recently, perhaps I've had some other thoughts about some things, but Barsev at War, I think, is the real answer.
Fair.
Related to that, because this is a feeling that I've sort of had for a while, do you think that part of the enduring nature of Earth Dawn and the desire that fans have had over the past 20 odd years at this point to keep coming back and keep doing that has anything to do with the fact that Barsev at War didn't come out? Do you think that if that had come out and then the game had ended, that that would have been a closing point that would have had people feel like there wasn't this need to come back and finish this story, that there was like a cliffhanger feeling that was going on?
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know if I've ever thought about it that way before, but it's certainly possible, right? We sort of, you know, Fassa released the Dragon's book a few months later, right? I think.
PDF.
Yeah, it was like put up like the rough layout PDF kind of thing.
Right, the PDF, right.
No art.
Yeah, it's interesting, sort of. I mean, it was, if the Dragon's book was the last book published in the first edition era, then it is about as big a cliffhanger as you can get. Because by the end of that book, you find out that this big magical family is really the child of dragons, and they have some pretty nasty plans afoot. And to be continued, and then the show was canceled, that's kind of, an unpleasant experience. Though, I guess, it, like I said, it's a very interesting take on it. I mean, I don't know that that event or set of sequence of events or part of the story, you know, it's hard to know how much it played into people's campaigns, right?
Mm.
I will say that it's very gratifying all these years later when I still run into people that tell me how much they've enjoyed playing Earth Dawn over the years. I mean, I haven't been involved with it since June of 1998, but it's still very gratifying to me that so much of the core foundation that we built back then is still enjoyed by so many people. But it is, that's a very interesting question to ask, right? Which is, because it ended on a cliffhanger, does that play into it at all?
Yeah, like, would we see a different situation? Because right now we are seeing like a lot of retro, that's not really the word, of
revival?
Well, yeah, sort of. But like a lot of games that were big back in that same era that had kind of gone away for a while are getting new editions, relaunches with Kickstarters and crowdfunding and stuff like that.
Oh, like a resurgence.
Yeah, like a nostalgia, a lot of nostalgia games coming out. To varying degrees.
It's funny, you wonder about, it's sort of like the same thing with TV shows and movies, like they just keep remaking the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah.
What's better, you know, I'm just going to pick a other property that's not, what's better, Deadlands 3rd Edition or something that's brand new? But I do think the nostalgia is part of it. You know, the people that in 1994, 1995, who could barely afford to buy the Earthdawn books when they came out, or had to share them across their kit. Now they have lots of extra disposable income. It's so cool. I'll buy it all again. So it's probably part of it. The nostalgia, disposable income is wonderful.
Yes. eBay is my friend and my addiction.
I have a pretty big collection of Disney books. Thanks to, I've been spending it in a different place. That's all.
Totally. Well, hey, what's this cash I have in my hand? Just take it. Here it goes. So, this is a fun question to kind of get off some of the serious topics we've been on. If Josh and I are questers, as I announced on the beginning of every show now, is Lou therefore a passion in Earth Dawn terms?
Well, I don't think so.
Again, fun question to ask. This same emailer says, could you share a fun little story from an Earth Dawn game you have played or game mastered? Maybe from your first edition days. They just want to hear a fun little tale.
Hmm.
You know, blood monkeys, whatnot. You know, tale at the table.
Let's see. I have shared this before, but Shattered Pattern originated as a game, an adventure I ran in my campaign with my friends, my wife and friends. We had a regular Earthdawn game, and I had to come up with something, and I had this image of, I think it started with the image of the person strapped to the big floating slab with their blood dripping into the big cauldron. I don't know if you remember Shattered Pattern, but that was a particularly fun image that came, right? And so that was an adventure I ran that turned out pretty good. And then we needed a book. And so I said, well, I have this thing. I can flesh it out and make it we can make a product out of it. And the rest of the company folks were like, sure, let's do that.
Yeah.
And I shared that for a very long time. Well, a very long time. Several months, it showed up on the production schedule and notes as Lou's Excellent Adventure, is what it was called. Because we didn't know have a name for it. So.
Kind of like Bill and Ted's.
Another fun little anecdote. So some of the lines and quotes that opened some of the chapters came from my game. Mm-hmm. One of them is this, I believe the character's name is Scythian. It was a Windling thief. And he says, of course it's a stupid plan. Most of our great ideas started with stupid plans, or it's a stupid idea. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but
that line's been uttered by just about every single gaming group ever. Of course, it's a stupid idea, but we're going to go with it anyway.
And then there is a, I don't know how silly this is. It's a little gory. Apologies in advance to animal rights folks. There is a story that my players tell. I don't remember the details of it, but that the players got the attention of a dragon. And the dragon left a message by basically biting a horse in half and using the other half as a big pen, as a big marker on the ground to write a note to them.
Echoes of what happened to Hefera in Prelude to War.
Yes. So, that's a fun memory of the player. They talk about that. Every so often I'll see that a couple of them in Facebook make offhanded references to that. Like, yikes.
Nicely done. So you mentioned working with Greg Gordon on Torg, and he got you into Earth Dawn as well. The question is basically, what was it like working with Greg, aside from the rewarding experience that you just kept following him to wherever he went?
It was a great experience. So like I said, I started playtesting, but by then I had his phone number so I could call. And I started at FAST in December of 92, and the game came out in August of 93.
Yeah, August was Gen Con that year. Yeah.
Right. May of 93 is when I was married. That's why. That's why that was an important time. But that whole time, I was on the phone with him very frequently, you know, and he had actually, at one point, when he delivered the final version of his manuscript, he started to second guess the whole multi-dice thing. And so he created an alternate version of the step table that leveraged the D8 much more. So it was like more multiples of D8s than using the multi-dice, the different polyhedrals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember conversations with him about the length of the combat round, like, because Tom Dowd wanted me to shorten it. I think it was 10 seconds at the time. He wanted me to shorten it to like 3 or 4 mm-hmm. seconds. And so at first I thought about it, and Greg's like, but that's going to change all the range, like the effectiveness of all the ranged weapons. That's going to make an impact on that, because time and distance, you know, work together, right? So in terms mm-hmm. of yeah. how effective yeah. some, you know, things like that would be. I remember one time I started to worry about the disparity between physical defense and attack steps, because physical defense doesn't change much, right? Mm-hmm. If it changes by 50% over the course of your whole career, that's a huge swing, right? It's going to stay largely static, but your attack step's going to keep going and going and going. And that's partly offset by, it's supposed to be offset by the increases from durability to unconsciousness and death rating. So just to sort of calm my nerves, I called him once, and we whipped up characters on either side of the phone, and we played out a fight between them, just to see how things, you know, change the numbers and see how things would go. And I remember the other guys in the office like, mm-hmm. Sam, Lou's playing Lou's playing games. they thought that was kind of fun. But literally, they heard me on the phone.
But you're paying me, Greg, too.
Like, rolling. Okay, I got a 17. That's a 25 points, of, you know, whatever the damage was.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was a good experience. You know, he has a background in combinatorial mathematics, I think.
Never could have told by the designs that he put out.
Right, exactly. Well, and then I don't know if you're familiar with DC Heroes, Josh, but it's built on a logarithmic scale.
Yeah.
And so every increase and everything is measured in what they call attribute points, but every increase by one attribute point doubles its real world value. So like one attribute point's 10, one AP of distance is 10 feet, two is 20, three is 40, four is 80, blah, 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 like that. But it allows for a setting where Jimmy Olsen with a strength of 2 can exist in the same world as Superman with a strength of 35, because that change is still that big. And actually, in the first version of DC Heroes, Superman, a strength of 50 was crazy. He could move the sun and stuff. It was, you know, but that was pre-crisis, and Superman was pretty godlike back then anyway.
As you should.
So math has long played a fundamental part in Greg's games. And before DC Heroes, he worked on James Bond, 007.
Oh, wow.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a very cool experience. I, you know, got to sort of pick his brain and sort of understand how he sort of approached things. And then, you know, I think I mentioned this on a post recently on the Facebook group, is that, well, in general, he did the work, he did the rules, and Christopher Kubasik did the setting. There were elements of both that they each did, like the Questa rules. I think Christopher did those. And so that's why they're originally, if you look at them, they're far more sort of narrative and storytelling. You know, they're three abilities with pretty broad application, and it's not as finely tuned as the rules for other things. But there were aspects of the rule of the setting that more came from Greg, like Obsidian were Greg's, the Light Bearers, that's the thing that I think prompted it, were largely Greg's idea. And that was one of those things that, when the game came out, it was just too big. So the companion became the stuff that we didn't fit in the core rulebook, pretty much. And the Lightbearers was certainly one of those things. And
that makes sense.
You know, and again, I mentioned about the Questers before. A big reason why they never showed up is it didn't fit in the story. Mm-hmm. Horrors played a role, but there was no concerted focused campaign on fighting the horrors or whatever, because the horrors are a collection of bad creatures, but they're not a collective.
Yeah.
Right? They don't work together.
No.
One of the stories I heard about some of the plans that never came to be from Living Room Games involved the horrors deliberately trying to find and destroy pattern items of Bar Save. And it never made sense to me because that is more of a, there's not a hierarchy. There's no king of the horrors. It's, they don't work together. They do their thing and they do similar things, but they don't really work together.
Yeah. That would be a concerted effort.
Yeah. So, right. So, and I don't want to get into bashing them because they help keep the game alive, right? Without their contribution, who knows? We might not be talking right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so some parts of the setting trace back to Greg's contributions more than Chris's, where, and vice versa. A couple parts of the rules basically Chris came up with. I think the other one was, I think, this riverboat or airship combat rules.
Airship combat? Yeah.
And he did a lot of that stuff. Christopher was mostly focused on the things that would show up in his novels.
That makes sense.
Because he was writing a trilogy of novels. I mean, he did a lot of fleshing out of other stuff that really didn't show up, but you can sort of tell the pieces that played a bigger part in the novel had a little bit more depth to them and a little bit more fleshed out stuff.
Agreed. So as much as you want to talk about this, what's it like to officially go from one system, as you said, DC Heroes a little bit, Torg, to Earthdawn? What's it like going from one system to another system, and any kind of culture shock associated with that environment, with people you're working with, the creative environment? Or
you mean in terms of working on and writing for?
I'm going to guess that's what it is, because I'm interpreting the question that was submitted.
Because I got to believe almost everyone here has done this from a player or game master standpoint, right? They've played D&D and then they played Top Secret, or then they played Call of Cthulhu, or they played Deadlands or
Star Wars,
yeah. Whatever, right? It's not culture shock. I mean, you do have to sort of, it's like in any job, you learn how to work with people in different departments and who have different strategies and different approaches to how they do things. So the conversation, for instance, I did some freelancing for TSR along the way too, right? So a conversation I might have had with Bruce Hurd at TSR was probably different than the one I was going to have with Greg at West End Games when I was working on a Torg thing, or the one I had with Bill Smith at West End Games when I worked on a Star Wars thing, right? So it's not so much culture shock as it is being adaptable. You know, you just need to meet people where they are and work with people where they're coming from. And I don't know if that's really responsive to the question, but
we'll hope so.
Works for me.
We will hope so. Yeah. So this is like a three-part, because I think these overlap a little bit. And so there's like three questions that are kind of the same thing. And I think you've maybe gone into it a little bit. Is there a setting book you would love to see in print covering an area that you feel needs some more love? Or is there one thing that you would change that you'd like from the fourth edition that says, oh, that's a great idea, I hadn't thought about that, but it's a great, great change, setting rules, whatever the case may be?
All right, I'm going to start with the second part first because I think it's easier.
Go for it.
I was mentioning this to Josh before you joined us. I don't necessarily agree with some of the way things were done in fourth edition and for some parts of the rules. That's just my opinion. I haven't played it, so it's one of those sort of non-sustainable, supportable opinions, right?
Just based on
my understanding of it, this is, I disagree with when you hear we changed X for reason Y. Like, I don't agree with reason Y.
Yeah, it's like people...
And I didn't use that because of the word Y, by the way.
No, it's pizza toppings. People don't like pizza toppings. You know, same thing.
But at the same time, as I've learned more, and I've learned a lot about fourth edition by listening to this podcast, quite honestly, right? I think the paths are very, very cool. And I think it's a much better way to do what we did with racial disciplines. Most of those work better as paths. And I think the way the path system was developed works out, I think, is really cool. I was always very fond of NACs, talent NACs. I always thought that was a cool thing. Unfortunately, I think the same one challenge that happened with first edition also happened with fourth edition, is that due to space concerns, you couldn't really feature NACs in the first rule book.
Yeah.
But to my way of thinking, it's better to incorporate them right from the beginning so everybody knows what their options are right from the outset. Like, we didn't do that until Magic, a Manual of Mystic Secrets. So we did it 2 years later. But it answered some questions, right? Like, people should be able to use these cool talents in slightly different ways if they pay a little bit more for it, right? If they invest a little bit more, mm-hmm. you know, and some of my favorites were, honestly, and this goes back to my favorite discipline, the Swordmaster, right? Well, some of the riposte talent knacks were just really cool.
No kidding.
Spell riposte? I mean, how cool is that? That's like the epitome of way over the top adept magic. You're so cool with your sword and magic that you can take this lightning bolt spell and refer it back at me. That's just very cool. So I love the fact that the paths make such use of the knacks, because I think it, again, it fills in the space. They also address half magic, which I think is another kind of cool thing that we slipped in later, which is, what's all this other stuff that an adept can do that we don't want to model in specific skills and talents? Because otherwise the character sheet becomes this unreadable mess.
Yeah.
And it becomes mm-hmm. overwhelming. So that's one of the things I think is very cool in terms of the fourth edition stuff. In terms of a place, like a setting, an area within Barsave that I would have liked to address, I would have liked to do Iopus. I'm sure it would have turned out a little different, you know, but it would have been fun to explore that. Yeah, just to sort of flesh out that whole corner of Barsave and who's aligned with who and how they're going to impact the future of the story moving forward.
Absolutely. I can see that.
Those were the two questions, right?
Yeah. Good answers. Good answers. Josh, rebuttal? I'm kidding. I'm kidding. So follow-up question. If you could change anything, either a specific rule or something in the setting from how it was actually put out, you can say, yeah, that got pushed through without my notice, or this didn't quite work out the way we thought it was going to work out, or this didn't. Yeah, these rules didn't quite work.
I think almost without reservation, I would say multi-disciplines. If I could take one thing back, the first thing on my list.
Fair.
But again, I think we talked about this before you joined us, or maybe just as you were joining us earlier, right?
We have talked about this multiple times, I think, over the years, Lou.
Right. It was a late addition to the game, and it was largely, D&D players like multiclassing, so we should have a version of multiclassing. We didn't have a chance to playtest it much. And quite honestly, the whole game, we sent it to a bunch of playtesters, but it's hard to... Most of the playtesting I did in the beginning was like a mini campaign where we would use it in context. And it wasn't, we'll make fifth circle characters and see how they work. We'll make eighth circle characters and see how they work. It was more, we're going to play this game as our weekly game. We're going to take notes and figure out what doesn't work and advise it, but we're not going to stress test the system because that's not as much fun, right? So a lot of gaming groups, I don't think, did that either. I don't know that the game was tested extensively in the upper circles, you know, and one of the other things that people notice, one of the other consequences or prices of the multidiscipline rules was one of the ideas from the early days was that as it got into the upper levels, like the master levels, master circles, that disciplines would start to take on the abilities of other disciplines, which is why some of those 13, 14, 15 circle talents in first edition were like first and second and third circle talents for other disciplines. It seemed weird that a 13th circle warrior would get forge weapon, right? And I don't remember if that's exactly an right one, but some of the talents they were getting way late were first and early circle talents for others, because the intent was as they get really developed, they need to broaden a little bit. So we'll give them these other things. Well, then you throw in multidiscipline and all of a sudden those things become almost useless, because for a small legend point expenditure, they can basically become a third circle weaponsmith. You know, as if a fifth or sixth level circle swordmaster can become a third circle weaponsmith without spending that much, relatively speaking, to their own abilities, because of the scale at which the cost of the things go up, because of the Fibonacci series. I loved it because it, you know, I did the same math that you did, Josh, that I figured out that it takes 5 years at optimum play to make it. And I thought that was a good thing.
Yeah.
Because there should only be a handful of 13, 14, 15 circle adepts of any discipline in Barsave, right? There shouldn't be 100 of them.
Yeah.
There should be 10 of them.
Yeah.
Right. Or maybe not 10, but you know.
Small handful.
I sort of like that.
Get to six circle, retire, and open a bar.
Right. But the challenge then being, right, how do you, you know, 25,000 legend points and now my melee weapons is one better, as opposed to I could use those same points to be to become third circle in like four disciplines, you know? Now, obviously, multidiscipline more than one, more than a second is not something that really happens except for the L's with the, on the wheel and the path and the journey and such.
Yeah.
So long way to say the multidiscipline rules probably, but the what compounds it is we created NPCs that were multiple disciplined. And so, and those were cool characters. And so we couldn't really go back and say these rules don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
So funny story, you know, it's like we couldn't just go in and change that page in the book to artwork for the next printing. And the reason I use that as a specific example in Shadowrun first edition, if you look at like the book I have is a first printing of the Shadowrun first edition rulebook. If you get a soft cover from like this, like a second printing, I think even.
Yeah.
There's certain pages where paragraphs are missing and been replaced with artwork.
Oh.
I was literally in a game once and I'm like, look on page 52 on the right column. It talks all about, I can't remember what it was about. I think it was about splitting your attack dice. I can't remember what it was. Splitting, counting successes a different way. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, it's right there. And he goes, look, I got a picture there. What are you talking about? And literally they had replaced a paragraph of text with a piece of art. And I asked Tom about it. And he's like, yeah, that rule didn't really work. So we just kind of covered it up.
We didn't mean for that to happen.
But again, we were too in deep with the multidiscipline thing. So we couldn't really do that. But that's the one thing I probably would have changed.
Fair, fair, fair. Josh, you?
Question applies unilaterally.
I agree. Multi-disciplines make multi-discipline and human versatility are the biggest nightmare for designing new abilities.
Yeah, I mean,
because it means that anybody in theory can get access to them. So you need to think about how they interact with everything else.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that before, and I get it. Though I'm
not as down on versatility as some people, but yeah.
No, I understand the concern. I just wonder if it's. I think part of what's interesting about the way people play these games is this emergent stuff, right? Which is, I never thought about combining this before.
Yeah.
Versatility by itself, I think, is a cool thing. It makes humans sort of different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like, the Journeyman was an interesting experiment in terms of all they have is versatility, and they just have to buy whatever it is they want. It's a very different approach to, you know, it's such a different thing. And it obviously took us, it forced us to write special, you know, rules about which ones can be used for which, and you can't have multiples of this, and you can't do this, and you know, you can't take all the spell matrices from, you know, from like,
yeah, I know.
But yeah, I mean, it do add a bit of a design challenge.
A little bit.
When anything can work with anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the one thing you never got to introduce? Had you been doing this longer than the 5.5 years you were doing it, given enough time in the bar save map or outside the bar save map, what is one thing you would have liked to have just ever gotten to that was not on your radar back then that probably hit your radar in the last 25 years?
Hey, this is an interesting question.
That is an interesting
question. I've already alluded to it. I think one thing is the return of the Earthbond. I think that would be fun. It would have been cool to explore what civilizations would have been like in the different areas of the world, particularly further away, North America, South America, Antarctica, Australia.
Yeah. Oh, Antarctica.
And even Cathay. I mean, right. Had we gotten to the point where we explored Cathay, I'm sure it would have turned out to be a little different than what they did in third edition.
Great.
I'll say that there are some plot threads and things that we left that I had in mind to revisit at some point. So the game comes out and there's horrors and there's Therans, and we decide that we're going to kick the Therans out because they're, you know, we did the Theran Empire book, we did Skypoint by Vane. They didn't catch on fire. They didn't do so great in terms of sales that it was a clear winner. So we decide in Prelude to War and Bar Save at War that we're going to kick the Therans out.
Yeah.
Right. The Therans make their push in Prelude to War. And an interesting tidbit, my original thought for that was that it would be way down near like in Carafad. My original thought was they landed a behemoth down near Carafad and basically took their corner and did this with it.
Yeah.
Their corner of territory, you know, they had Skypoint by Vane, but they just claimed a little bit more. And we had a summit meeting where we invited a bunch of authors to us to talk about our plans. And I pitched this, and Sean Rhodes, the guy from the Super River, goes, no, if you want to do this, stick it in Lake Ban right here. That'll cause some problems. So it was his idea to put the Life Rock there.
He's at fault.
But so the intent was we'll kick the Therans out for now as of Barsav at war, and then we'll focus on the Danarastus. There'll be a new guy, but the Therans will come back at some point. But there were other little tidbits here and there. There was one in particular that I wanted to explore other potential threats to the world beyond just the horrors, who should be becoming a lesser and lesser extent threat to the world, and the Therans, who, depending on how you look at it, might be defeatable. Mm-hmm. If enough of the peoples of the world focus their efforts, they might be able to actually win, right? They're not an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
But there's potentially other things that could threaten the world and other dangers. You know, what if there's a threat so big that the Therans decide they need to team up with Barsav, the races of Barsav?
That'd be neat.
That's something big and bad, right? So there were a couple long, long-term thoughts, things I don't think I ever wrote down. They were just a little, hey, what if we do this one day?
Yeah, I like that. So this other emailer was asking, since he's currently preparing a huge interconnecting map with all the plot hooks for a ready-to-play-it-all Foundry world, that's a technology I don't even want to get into right now, this emailer was wondering about the storyline between Prelude to War and Empty Thrones. Josh, you guys probably fill in some of this as well.
Okay.
He knows there's not likely anything coming to support this item, but since we're going to be playing this in his group, basically starting from 1505 Thrall up to the current date, he was wondering if there's any ideas in Lou's head of what should have happened during this time frame. He reads and hears a lot about things and really enjoys all the plot hooks and ideas. So a basic framework would be enough, like Orichalcum loci and grand ideas.
Yeah, we've kind of covered a lot of it. My feeling would be look at the, if you can find it, because it's out there, the Barsav at War outline, which a lot of the fourth edition history chapter in the GM's Guide is based on, with some little differences from the living room games. I've talked about some of the issues I had with the choices that they made in some of that.
A whole other episode about that.
Yeah. I'm sure it's somewhere in the archives. And just kind of go with that. I don't know that there's necessarily, like, lose it. I really liked the shape of the story of Barsav at War.
Yeah.
And just the difficulty of how do you involve player characters in that in a way that is meaningful. And I think there are plenty of places within that story that that could happen. The small elite squad that needs to get inside the Triumph in order to get the wards down so that the troops can attack. Those are very definitely like player character mission kinds of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, just generally, we're not so much focused necessarily on, like, we have some ideas of kind of what's going on, but our plot advancement, storyline advancement kind of stuff is more of just finding interesting places to have interesting conflicts,
mm-hmm.
where people can set their own games. And then if down the road, like the consequences of that becomes interesting, then to revisit it or something.
Fair. To cure the next question, it was proffered. So done.
Yeah. And some of the things that we had thought about were things that would have happened in Barsav at War that already did, which, like, the taking of Jarrus and just some, what the Danarastus were going to do in the wake of the war was yet to be determined for us, at least.
Yeah.
At our point, this whole idea of Yul Danarastus being assassinated, I assume he was assassinated, he didn't just die of old age, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He exploded.
Right. Gives lots of interesting opportunities. And you know what? I've heard enough about you talking about it to know that it seems like some of what's going on in that book is only tangentially related to them. I mean, it is like a Danarastus is now in Kratos and things are happening, but as the action sort of gets further away from Iopis, the ties to the Danarastus become more tenuous and mm-hmm. and circumstantial more than central to the events.
Yeah. Honestly, Prelude to War was kind of the template that we were looking at in terms of designing that, which was, here is a pretty significant event that is going to have repercussions across the entire province. And then here are some things that are happening at the same time that are maybe kicked off in part or whatever, but they all kind of have the same theme because, yes, the Therans land, but then you've got the return of Krathus Gron and the whole Orc Nation storyline isn't really directly connected. It's just something that's kind of happening at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
And so they kind of interplay with each other. It's possible to do an entire arc where you cover everything in Empty Thrones, but each storyline serves as a pretty decent campaign arc on its own without necessarily needing to do everything.
Right. Yeah.
Fair. A few more mechanical questions, and I think we're almost tapped out. Emailer starts off, Earthdawn has many unique factors, not even including the horrors, obviously. The undead, for example, the cadaver men, consistently surprise the players. How were these aspects developed and trying to differentiate from other fantasy games? Was that like a collaborative effort? Or did somebody have the idea and you just said, yeah, go play with that? Or
they all came out of the creativity of the individual authors. Like, I think Greg Gordon did most of the creatures.
Yeah.
The creature section, right? So he created Vergigorm and he probably created the Cadavermen. You know, and this whole idea of the Berserker thing. I'm not sure where it came from, but it's turned into a fan favorite. Well, at least a GM favorite, right?
GMs are fans. Yes, we'll go with that.
But again, I think it's, you know, you mentioned before, it's sort of just the creative process. Just people have ideas and they play with them. You know, like I think the Shadow Man, I think, came because that's a cool idea, right? A flying monster looks like manta rays are cool, right? We all think those are cool. What if they flew and attacked you? You know, like, that's kind of neat. Honestly, some creatures and some stuff came out of artwork. Concept design, like the art boys, were given time, like, we're doing a fantasy world. Just do concept art. Just draw stuff and creatures and weapons and stuff.
Yeah.
So a handful of weapons. I think it's called a hawk hatchet, which is like this boomerang-like thing.
Oh, one of my favorites.
That came out of a drawing by Mike Nielsen. There's a creature called a stinger, which is this underground, subterranean thing that's got stingers on its mandibles and stinger tail. That was a drawing, a sketch that I saw. I'm like, that's cool. I'll make stats for that. I'll come up with something that's cool for that. So
yeah,
some of them came from artwork. Some of them, you know, it could very well be that Greg thought, well, everybody will think these are like zombies and that they, you know, when you wound them, they just fall. Instead, in our case, when you wound them and they get stronger. How about that? That's kind of cool.
Kind of neat.
I don't think there's a single answer to explain where all of it comes from, right? So it's...
Yeah, because the follow-up question was, why introduce Obsidian into Scrang? And that's already been answered, which is to differentiate from D&D, you know, who had all the half races and so forth and so on. So were there any other races, aside from the eight that we have, that were kind of developed but discarded?
No, by the time I got involved, those eight races were the eight player character races.
Gotcha.
You know, and I got to believe part of it was obviously we're going to have humans, we're going to have elves, we're going to have dwarves, we're going to have orc controls because they're in Shadowrun, right? So those four or those five races are all from Shadowrun.
Yeah.
But this is a time of Magic before. Let's have something else. And so they created the other three.
Completely makes sense to me.
Yeah, you know.
No argument here. So what input or knowledge do you have about the development of the magic system, since it's very different from the magic systems that were being developed in the early, mid, late 80s and 90s for other games at all? This question was, since it's very distinct from others that shall remain nameless, what were the thoughts about making that completely different, if you know anything behind that design process?
I think there are two aspects of this. And again, this was all largely in place by the time I got involved. But I think in terms of spell magic, all adepts are magical. So your warrior uses magic to power his melee weapon's talent. It may not always look it or seem it, but it's true. Because he can swing his sword every round, a wizard should be able to cast a spell every round, right? So
that's their thing.
We don't want to use spell slots, right? So we need another way to throttle availability of spells. And that's where matrices and threads came in. Mm-hmm. Rather than say you can only cast these five spells every 8 hours and after that, you know, we want to move away from the 15-minute adventuring day. The spell matrix and thread system was a way to sort of, again, throttle what a wizard could do, right? They could do it all day, but they may have to do it they could only have certain ones available and they can only do it every other round or however you want to look at that.
Yeah.
So that's definitely where that came from. It was a way of...
You have to put a limit on something.
Structuring the way that they had access to spell magic. In terms of magic items, it wouldn't surprise me if at some point something like this was said. You know, it's kind of dumb that you can just pick up a magic sword and start using it and it works. Like, I'm guessing one of the Greg or Chris or Jordan or Tom or Sam or somebody said something like that.
Yeah.
As a way to say, well, how can we do it differently then? What, you know, and as part of this, the development of the world, this whole idea of magical patterns becomes a bigger thing, right? It becomes a bigger conceit of the whole setting that everything has a true, everything that has a name has a true pattern. What does that mean? Well, a magic item has a true pattern and you can't really use its magic until you understand it. And so, you know, so I think that's probably where that came from too, right? Sort of like a reaction to D&D, to the idea that if you open the, if you break down the right door in a dungeon, your first level bard could walk out with a +5 Avenger.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of, I mean, obviously the DM has done something wrong in that case, but it was, you know, a response to that, I think, which is how should magic items work? Maybe they have to invest in them before they work.
And then I see that as a little balance to the game.
Having not only a cost, but a cost in terms of time and research and knowledge all played together to sort of create this other approach to how magic items work.
Yes. So I have like one follow-up question and then we can get to the sign-off here real quick, which is if you could, like an unlimited budget, if you could create a new game today, what would it be?
I could create a new game today.
Yeah. You got, I can't say unlimited time, but you got a couple of years, you got an unlimited budget. You're going to lean more sci-fi, more fantasy, more outer space, more, what you going to do?
So it won't sound that original now, but when I first had the idea for this game, it was quite original.
Yes.
I think. And that would be, I had ideas for a game where the gods of the ancient pantheons came back to Earth.
Yeah.
And bestowed their powers on their avatars, people who would be their avatars. And the avatars, some of the backstory turned into this big thing that's sort of like Torg, where the gods were battling for supremacy on Earth and potentially mystical energy and stuff. But the idea was, it came from, honestly, do you remember the Franklin Mint collections? Like the Franklin Mint used to do these cool things that you could put on your desk. And like a couple of them were Egyptian mummy.
Yeah.
Sarcophagus. And my wife has one. And I saw it and it's got the little eyes. And then I had an image of it with cyber eyes. And I thought, wow, wouldn't like Egyptian themed cybernetics be kind of cool? And that just sort of, it started with Egyptian stuff, right? Which is basically effectively superheroes, but their powers are bestowed on them by the Egyptian gods.
Yeah.
So the Avatar of Ra would be able to do some things. The Avatar of Horus would be able to do different things. And that they would have advanced technology, but it looked like ancient stuff. So now it feels like I'm describing Stargate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I happen to love. And it's actually a game I wrote for too. I wrote for the Alderac Entertainment version of Stargate. But I first started thinking about this before Stargate was a thing. I mean, the movie might've been a thing, but certainly the TV show wasn't a thing.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
So that was the game I always wanted to do, which was my Avatar game, which was, you know, and in different parts of the world, the different pantheons. So like you could also have Greek and Roman inspired avatars. So the Avatar of Apollo or the Avatar of Ares or the Avatar of Quetzalcoatl over in South America. So all the ancient pantheons would have come back at the same time. So there'd be lots of room for conflict and lots of cool looking guys and girls, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like, did you watch one of the Marvel shows?
The TV show, probably not, but I've seen all the movies though.
Oh gosh, which one is it? Moon Knight.
Oh, Moon Knight. Yeah. Moon Knight. Oh yeah.
So, you know, the female, when she becomes the Egyptian superhero,
mm-hmm.
In the end, like in the last episode,
mm-hmm.
She has like the metal wings and she's out kicking ass out in the street.
Yeah.
That's the exact kind of image that I had in mind for these avatars.
Nice.
Which were like superheroes, but they don't do superhero things, but all of their trappings are inspired by ancient civilization, ancient deities and ancient pantheon sort of artistic motifs.
Cool. You should look at Gods of the Fall from Monty Cook Games. That might be some inspiration for you.
Yeah, I mean, right. There's been a bunch of...
There's that. There's Scion. Totally. There's...
The Godsend Agenda by Yeah, there's a couple of different people have done similar things. So it's nothing I could do now because I'd be accused of being a copycat. But if you found the file creation date for some of my notes, it would have gone back to the early 90s.
That's absolutely great. I love it. Josh, same question.
No, I'm not going to answer it. Lou has the advantage of not being actively in development of anything at the moment. I can't distract myself.
Right. So, because you know what? If you start getting Josh thinking about some other game he wants to write, we'll never see the Europa Source.
And we need to see the Europa Source book. Yes, we do. Absolutely. So there's a couple of sign-offs here from other people. One emailer said, Lou, thanks for all of your work on my favorite RPG. Somebody else said, thanks to Dan and Josh for being awesome. Here's another 200 episodes. I think they're a little lofty in that ideal.
I mean, I do remember when we started that we didn't think we were like 200.
I thought 100 was going to like do us in, but 200 is a miracle at this point. And I think three is.
We appreciate everybody still being with us.
Anybody still being with us at this point as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots to talk about, but.
Fair. Lou, I absolutely appreciate all your time today in sitting down recording with you. It has been a fantastic educational experience. I love meeting you for the first time. Wish we could do this again more often.
I'm happy to come back whenever, but you know, it's not my thing, really. It's your thing, so it's all good.
We're just carrying the torch that you lit on fire.
But I'm going to keep listening. Like I think I mentioned before, I'm halfway through the episode about CARES. Every Wednesday, I go to my app and I download it and I read the notes to see what it's going to be. I'm not thrilled about the Rennell series just because, you know, but I get it. There's only so many.
Yeah.
What are you going to do, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, I'm not thrilled about the Rennell series either, but, you know, we have to mine for content and I've never used the Bloodwood other than Mist of Betrayal, essentially. So it's for those who like to be in the Bloodwood, we got to cover their stuff too.
Don't get me wrong. The Bloodwood is an interesting book because it was nominated for an Origins Award.
Nice.
And it was up against Delta Green, I think.
The original Delta Green,
I don't know if you remember the original Delta Green.
Yeah.
And I debated, honestly, which one I was going to vote for, even though I worked on the Bloodwood. And I ended up voting for the Bloodwood mostly because it was a book I was afraid of.
Yeah.
In some ways. Because we had built up this myth and lore about the Bloodwood. Oh, my God. It's so this cool place. Like, could we do it justice? Could we do a book that actually brings it to life in a way that lives up to this promise?
Yeah.
And I think we did.
I think
we
did.
You know, in the end, I think we really did. And so.
Yeah, I would agree.
But it's one of those situations. Like, it was one of the few books that I was sort of, like I said, afraid of. Just because I wasn't sure we were going to do it justice.
Mm-hmm. But no.
But in the end. And I don't mean to say that I think that it's bad or the Rennells are stupid or anything. It's just there's not as much meat on them as there were about the chapter about
the trolls,
the dragons, or the houses of the Skrang houses, or the sky the troll moots,
or the secret societies.
Right, secret societies. Any of the lots or the paths or lots of the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just more. I mean, they're all highfalutin elves, right? So they're doing their thing, right?
Yeah. Like I said, it reminds me a lot of the Vampire of Masquerade, just a lot of the political maneuverings and backstabby kind of things. And so it's less action and more, you know, political intrigue and all those machinations.
Interestingly enough, and completely coincidentally enough, the two people who wrote the bulk of that book had worked on Vampire. Jennifer Hartshorn and Ian Lemke wrote most of that book.
Nice.
With, you know, guidance and direction from us, but they had worked on, I think they were working at White Wolf at the time, actually.
It was an interesting crossover.
Like I said earlier, it's a small industry.
Yeah. And it wasn't like, oh, we're doing Bloodwood and these sales are like vampires, so let's find people. It didn't work out that way at all. They just,
no.
A lot of people did freelancing for other folks.
Oh, yeah.
Depending on their availability and such. I mean, I never did when I was working for FASA, but I think I could have if I wanted to. I did a handful of other things while I worked there. I wrote some articles for Shadis. I wrote an article for a short piece for Arcane magazine. I don't know if you even remember that. It only lasted like 4 or 5 issues.
Fair.
So I did some stuff, but you know, the expectation was most of our creative output would be for FASA.
Fair.
So, mm-hmm. Okay. You know,
cool. I also know that you've got some product of your own that's not actually Earthdawn related. You've written a couple of books on Disneyfying things because you're a big Disney fan. Please elaborate on that.
Yes. So I've written three books in what I call the Imagineering Toolbox series. And they're all about applying principles of Disney Imagineering. And the Imagineers and Imagineering are the people, the Imagineers are the people who design and build the theme parks and the resorts. Mm-hmm. And it's about applying principles and practices of Imagineering to other creative fields. Because I think, you know, I'm very interested in creativity, but I think one of the things that's traditionally somewhat lacking in the creativity literature are books about models of creativity that other people are doing. Like, you can find books about how to be more creative and how to have new ideas, et cetera. But very few of them are like, here's what Apple does to do their products, and here's how you can learn from it.
Yeah.
And there's been a couple. Creativity Inc. is an example where Ed Catmull, the guy, one of the founders of Pixar, did it. But I think Imagineering is one of the best examples of creativity that you can use as a model. It, the creation of theme park attractions and theme parks involves so many different disciplines. All the things that you do to create a role-playing game, you do for that in different ways. But it's graphic design and art and writing, but they add lighting design and sound design and ride attraction design and, you know, architecture and, you know, it's three-dimensional stuff. And so the books explore, the first book is called The Imagineering Pyramid and explores 15 principles that the Imagineers use when they design their attractions and how you can apply those to other fields. One of those chapters actually is specifically about game design. There's a whole chapter about it. So I go through these 15 principles, and there's a chapter in game design, like how these show up in game design specifically. And there's a whole bunch of references to Earth on there.
Good.
And then the second book is their process, the Imagineering process. It's a distillation, a simplification of the process they use from when somebody says, we need a new ride in Fantasyland, to 5 years later when they open up Seven Dwarfs Mine Train. And so it distills that into a seven-step process, again, with the idea of how you can use this in other fields and how you can apply this. And I use the same in the first two books have this exploration of the stuff, like the 15 principles or the seven-step process, and then a chapter on game design, instructional design, and management and leadership. And so in the second one, I did the same thing. And so, for example, in the second book, The Imagineering Process, in a couple of the steps, I go into some detail about the design process that we used to create some of the Earthbound products, particularly Prelude to War and Blades is one that I use a lot, because Blades was designed and intended as an example of how to incorporate magic items into your campaign. Because we have this cool system, but man, it's not easy to use, right? As a game master, like, it's, you've got to be ready to do it. So early on in some of those discussions with Greg, he's like, we should do a product someday that's an example of how to do a magic item. So we had this on the list. And then it was, well, if it's only a single magic item, then only one player really cares. So that's why it became a match set of daggers, as many as, really, I mean, we made it eight, but it could be as many as they need. If the party was 9 or 10, it could have been 9 or 10, right? And then the third book is, so one of the ideas in the first book was that it was about not only how to apply these principles to your projects, but also how to promote your projects.
Yes.
And I didn't think I did as great a job with that communication part in the first book as I could have. So the third book is written like a business fable. I don't know if you've ever read business fable, like Who Moved My Cheese or The 1 Minute Manager, or they're fictional stories about characters, but what they do, there's lessons in what they do, right? So it's sort of Bright Tales story. So in this book, a group of friends meet at Magic Kingdom and they take a tour of the Magic Kingdom with a former Imagineer who shows them how the Imagineers tell their stories, because these are old high school friends who only get together when one of their friends dies. Like, they're people, you know, they were the best of friends, but life pulls them apart. And the only time you ever see each other is at a funeral.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately is the truth for a lot of us. I was just last weekend, I was with two friends that I hadn't seen. And the last time I'd seen them was at previous funerals. So they decide to do a vacation together, to actually spend some time together. And when they're chatting the first night, they're talking about their jobs, and the common theme is that they all have problems with communication. So, like, one of them is the CEO of a small company that's getting bigger. He used to be able to talk about things at lunch with his team of 12. Now his team's 150. Can't do it that way anymore. He's got to come up with something else. One of them is a Disney travel agent who has trouble explaining to her clients that she doesn't charge anymore it doesn't cost any more to use her than it does to do it on your own, but she adds extra value. How does she communicate that? So they all have problems telling their story. So the Imagineer shows them how the Imagineers tell their story and how they can apply it to their own situations.
Yeah.
And it's written as a fictional book with this group of people that walk through the kingdom and such.
Very well done, sir.
Cool. I've been meaning to pick up those books since you first talked about them.
It's all good. I understand.
It is amazing because all three of us can go to Amazon and type in our own name and come up with product. And I think that's just a weird thing. That's a very surreal thing to do.
Right. Well, it's funny. So I think it was the third book. A friend of mine. So my wife and I ended up helping out with a local music boosters organization for many, many years because our kids were in band and chorus and such. And the band director, one day, the third book came out and I told him about it or something. It came up and he did that. He Googled me and he found a bunch of Earthbound stuff. He's like, so I found your Disney books, but I found some other stuff too. I'm not sure what this is all about. Because, you know, if you're not in this world, it's very alien.
Yes. Yes.
Right? If it feels like you came out of left field if you're not from this world. So I had to kind of, in a previous life, I pretty much worked as a game designer.
Absolutely. Nothing to shy away from. Josh, any follow-up questions? Anything I did not ask? I mean, you've had more conversations with Lou than I ever have, so.
God, no. No. We've been at this for 2.5 hours at this point. I really appreciate you providing us so much of your time, Lou.
I knew it would be more than an hour, but I didn't know it would go this long. And it's fine. I'm not complaining. I'm happy that I could probably talk.
Yeah.
I could keep you on for another 3 hours. That's just me.
Yeah, I could probably keep going, but yeah. So, yeah.
Always great to talk to you. I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate your support of the show and you sharing your memories and insights and everything on the Facebook group and
all
this like stuff. Some of which I knew, some of which I didn't. So it's great.
Yeah, it's like director's commentary on a DVD.
Some of them are very obscure little things that I just, I can't remember what off the top of my head, but every so often something will come up like, oh yeah, this reminds me of this one day when this guy said this thing. And it was just completely, some of them are stories we've talked about before. Some are just like, I hadn't thought about that in 100 years,
Fair. Lou, I'm going to give you the sign off for the show. And I think what you signed into any Earthdawn book, I think needs to be the last three words for today's show.
Right. So we will sign off with the words that were once my screensaver when I worked at FASA. It bounced across my screen when I was away from my desk. And those words are, Earthdawn forever, baby.
See you next time, folks.
Good night.